We have live with us in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Still adjusting to our new digs, our new time.
I'm not. I'm sleeping in. I enjoy it.
Yeah. I love it.
Well, for the rest of us, because it's just me. All right. So plenty to cover. I know you were both riveted this week by the Mayor Durkin's State of the City
that
address.
Would be one word for it.
Can't say I was necessarily riveted. Durkin delivered her
nauseated, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, she delivered her address on Tuesday at North Seattle Community College. Of course, she used it as an opportunity to brag about all the stuff that she's done.
Actually, or all the stuff other people have done.
Yeah, other people have done that she's taking credit for. And there's actually quite a bit in there that was done by the city council and nonprofits and other people on behalf of the city that Mayor Durkin is taking credit for, one of which is like the $15 an hour minimum wage, which actually was passed long before Durkin entered the scene. And I found it kind of interesting that she would take credit for something that was initiated and really pushed hard by Shama Sawant.
Yes, the city council person whose name shall never pass Durkin's lips.
Yeah. And so, of course, she laid out some of her guiding principles for what to do in the coming year, because that's typically what part of the State of the City address is all about. One part is summing up what's happened in the last year or two of her term, and then laying out what she's going to be doing in the next year. She started with some guiding principles: diversity, protection against gentrification and displacement, an economy that actually benefits workers, preventing homelessness and building true economic opportunity. And all those sound really great. Sounds like you're listening to Shama Sawant there.
And none of those are things that she's actually doing. And many of those are things that she's actively making worse.
Yeah. And so she talked a little bit about what she would be doing in the next year. First on that list is continuing to push the navigation team, which I think violates a lot of those guiding principles right there. In addition, she talked about building more 24/7 homeless shelters, which would route people into housing, while defunding emergency shelters, although she didn't really talk about defunding emergency shelters, although that is a big piece of what she has actually done in the last 2 years. Instead, she bragged about an increase in the overall number of shelters, which, of course, is due to the city council restoring funding to emergency shelters, funding that she ruthlessly cut out of the budget.
And she really didn't address the fact that there's referring people to housing doesn't really work when there's no housing to refer people to.
She did mention more affordable housing, and she cited the upzoning process and using empty, unused city properties for construction of affordable housing. And it's important to remember that it was advocates for the homeless who first pointed out that the city could use vacant city properties for this purpose, for emergency shelters or for affordable housing. And so yet again, we have Mayor Durkin taking credit for trying to own an issue that was originally brought to everyone's attention by people who were fighting on behalf of homeless people to try to help get them off of the street, and who were activists initially fighting against gentrification.
Speaking of gentrification, there's all the upzone.
Yeah, and you'll notice that she didn't propose any additional funding for affordable housing. It was all just relying on the upzoning. And we'll talk about that here in a minute, too. She also talked about expanding her program to make the first 2 years of college in Seattle free to low-income students, a great program. Starting a new scholarship for low-income college students who need more assistance than just free tuition for things like books, room and board, academic fees, et cetera. Another great idea. We'll see where she looks for the money for that program. Expansion of the city's affordable preschool program, a great program too, but again, not benefiting very many families yet. She talked about a teardown of the Alaskan Way Viaduct and construction of the waterfront park, all things that started well before she became mayor. Refurbishing Key Arena for the Seattle Kraken, the new NHL team, which she called the Krakens, which I think is not a correct plural form of Kraken, but, you know, you can argue that point. Again, a process that bringing both an NBA team and an NHL team to Seattle in some form or another began well before Durkin what was elected to office. She talked about bringing light rail to Ballard and West Seattle. That's a Sound Transit thing that she does not have any control over. And finishing the City Connector streetcar line along First Avenue downtown, something she does have control over, which is highly controversial at this point because there are many folks in Seattle who think that's an enormous, enormous waste of taxpayer money. She wants to work with the Seattle Housing Authority and King County Metro to provide free ORCA card passes to 1,500 low-income residents of the city of Seattle. In other words, expanding her program, free ORCA cards for high schoolers in Seattle to low-income residents.
Which that program, too, was started by students in various high schools, including Rainier Beach.
Asking
so they
for
were
that.
Really the spearhead
and,
of that.
And I should also point out that employees of the University of Washington had been pushing for that in their negotiations with the University of Washington. Again, that idea has been around for a long time. It's not new with Mayor Durkan. And she said that she was sending a bill to the city council, and she did this week, to require all new buildings in Seattle to include electric charging stations for electric cars. And she did that this week. And that's a good idea. Of course, it's not one that takes that requires any money to be spent on the part of the city. It just requires developers to include an amenity with their new buildings. So that's an easy lift for her.
And there'll be developer pushback on that.
And
there certainly
will.
We don't want to burn developers any more than they already are.
Yeah, there certainly will. And of course, we'll see who takes the flack for that, whether it's the mayor or the city council, if it eventually passes. My guess is it'll probably be the city council.
Yeah, and I can think of a few requirements for developers that would be much more significant and much more important than that.
Yeah,
you know, including low-income housing, significant low-income housing.
One-for-one replacement.
Yes, but we'll get to that, too.
Shall we talk about that?
Wait, before
or
you...
Or did you... Okay.
Before you jump in there, isn't it, in her defense, don't mayors traditionally just get up and take credit for other people's stuff?
Yeah.
She's doing it more than most do. I mean, Ed Murray was a master at it, and she's really surpassing Murray in terms of that.
It seems to almost be a requirement for the job. What the mayor's job really is to try to oversee the functioning of the city's various departments and to make sure that nothing gets too far out of line, that the city adheres to the budgeting process that's passed, the budget that's passed by the city council, and to initiate the start of new programs, kind of to make sure everything runs smoothly. Mayors don't actually create, mayors don't actually pass legislation typically. It's the city council that does, but mayors can initiate legislation and pass it to the city council and say, I would like you to consider this and I would like you to discuss it and hopefully pass it.
Yeah, the most significant things that mayors do is oversee in this case, the 12,000 or so city employees.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the number of vacancies that have occurred in different city apartments in the last year, in the first year of Durkan's term, and the relative slowness and certainly the lack of transparency with which Durkan has tried to fill those roles, and we should mention that the relevant city council committee voted to delay the appointment of a new HSD director,
the Human Services Department director.
Yeah, and that again is something where Durkan just wanted to appoint the existing interim director, Bruce Johnson, without any real process for hiring. And that's something that's very controversial among affordable housing and homelessness advocates.
Yeah, so we will see what happens with that. One of two things could happen. Mayor Durkan could give in and open up the process for a new Human Services Department director to allow public input and input from employees from the Department of Human Services and she had promised that they would have some input.
And some of them have actually testified in public hearings against Johnson and against his management when he was the associate director and some of the actions that he has taken as interim director.
Yeah, and that would be the wise move on her part, but I'm guessing Durkan is not going to do that. The other thing that could happen is other city council members could vote to remove the confirmation process from Shama Sawant's committee and move it to a different committee and or take it on as a city as the city council as a whole. That could also happen. Hopefully that will not happen.
Has that been done before anytime recently?
I think it's very rare. I've not seen it done recently.
All right.
But it is possible.
Yes, anything is possible with our city.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Durkin also put out this week a 5-page executive order on low-income housing to, quote, stabilize low-income and minority communities in the face of runaway displacement. Many of her policies, of course, encourage that runaway displacement. And there was really nothing new in that. There were a lot of big words in it, but nothing particularly new except one program, a community preference policy giving preference and access to displaced neighborhood residents for publicly subsidized low-income housing built in neighborhoods where they were displaced. Of course, that comes a little bit too late for Yesler Terrace residents who were scattered around the city and only a fraction of which have been promised new homes in the redeveloped Yesler Terrace. It really does nothing for the 3 to 4 numbers of times of subsidized units that are being destroyed compared to the ones that are being created currently. And that ratio would continue under Durkin's proposals. And of course, with upzoning, which we will get to, it would be increased that much more. There was really nothing in Durkin's proposals that would help with that, which is a glaring omission that I'm sure she will take credit for in her next State of the City address. Lisa Herbert, city council member, did come out with an anti-displacement plan of her own this week.
Can I talk a little bit about the mayor's
executive
order for a second? In her community preference policy, one thing that I found very interesting is that she said that the Office of Housing would develop a legal framework so that city-funded properties can rent affordable units to local neighborhood residents first on a preferential basis before renting to Seattle residents or people moving in from other neighborhoods or other cities around the country. This is for certain neighborhoods, it says, the executive order says, for certain neighborhoods that are at high risk for gentrification and displacement, although her executive order doesn't define which neighborhoods are included. It doesn't name them. It just kind of is, it makes it look like it's very vague.
Yeah, it also doesn't define gentrification or displacement for that matter.
No, in addition to some of the other things, which are expansions of programs that are already in existence, for example, like directing the Office of Housing to work with the Seattle Housing Authority to take out more loans, yet more loans by the Seattle Housing Authority to buy and preserve subsidized buildings that are under threat of being lost to development. Those are programs that are already ongoing. And expanding the home repair program for low-income residents to be able to afford to do home repairs at very low cost so that they can stay in their homes, those kinds of things. One other new thing that it included was that the mayor's office will drop a prospectus to get wealthy investors to throw money into opportunity zones in places like the International District, Judkins Park, Othello, Yesler Terrace, First Hill, the Central District, Rainier Beach, Soto, Pioneer Square, and Beacon Hill. Now, you'll notice that in talking about the economic opportunity zones that were set up by the Trump tax bill, which lets investors who make money building housing in low-income opportunity zones pay a lower tax rate on their profits from those buildings, you know, when she gets excited about a capitalist opportunity like this that lets investors make big money, you know, with very low taxes involved, she's very specific about which neighborhoods are included in the tally and which neighborhoods will be affected.
Whereas, my guess is she was probably given a list by somebody.
Oh, yeah. When it's important to investors to know that information, she will give that information. When it's important for Seattle's residents, who she's supposed to be serving, to know which neighborhoods will benefit from the preference policy, she doesn't give any specifics. And that tells you something about the priorities of our mayor.
And also who gives input when she's crafting these policies.
Yeah. And yeah, exactly. Who's behind her in crafting some of these policies. So let's talk a little bit about Lisa Herbold's draft anti-displacement ordinance.
Yeah, for one thing, it calls for one-for-one replacement of you know, affordable housing that's being displaced by development. This is something that affordable housing advocates have been calling for something like 30 or 40 years in Seattle and would have helped a long, long time ago. It's gotten very little traction historically on city council, let alone from mayors. In a political process that has been dominated by developers that are highly resistant to one-to-one displacement. It does not, however, challenge upzones, which would require a great deal more one-for-one replacement. And it doesn't really explain how that one-for-one replacement is going to be funded. The city really doesn't have a lot of available funds to finance that itself. Apparently, that would have to come on the backs of developers. So
yeah.
There would be a lot of pushback to that.
Yeah, my reading of the ordinance is that it would require developers to do one-to-one replacement.
Yes.
or pay a higher rate into the city's housing trust fund to build.
Yeah.
More affordable housing in the same neighborhood.
And the rate that's currently paid into that housing trust fund, it does not come anywhere near actually matching the cost it requires to construct or purchase that housing for one-for-one replacement.
So and the ordinance doesn't give a set rate, so it would be interesting to see. It's like it's a stepping stone to get to a higher rate that developers would pay into the fund in certain neighborhoods. Now, her ordinance does a couple things, one of which is it gives the city the right to reject permits for projects if necessary to protect affordable housing, which mm-hmm. is a first, I think. And it does another thing. She names the neighborhoods where this ordinance would affect. Bitter Lake, Othello, South Park, Rainier Beach, and Westwood Highland Park. You'll notice that list is much smaller than the list of neighborhoods that Durkin wants to open opportunity zones to gentrify, essentially. And it's interesting to me where these neighborhoods are. Bitter Lake is in North Seattle. It's between Aurora and Greenwood Avenue, north of 105th Street and south of 145th. It's where a lot of Seattle's Latino population live. There's a lot of low income region of North Seattle, probably the last bastion of that in North Seattle. Othello's in South Seattle. It's the area surrounding the junction of South Othello Street and Martin Luther King Way, to the east of Beacon Hill and west of Rainier Valley. It's at risk of redevelopment because of the Othello Street light rail station. South Park in South Seattle is south of Georgetown. It's bordered by Highway 509 on the west and the Duwamish Waterway and Boeing Field on the east. South Cloverdale Street and 14th Avenue South are the main thoroughfares through South Park. Rainier Beach is southeast of Boeing Field, where Rainier Avenue South turns and heads along Lake Washington, and its proximity to Lake Washington is the main threat for redevelopment of Rainier Beach, typically a heavily African-American neighborhood. Westwood Highland Park is on the city's southern border, just to the west of South Park, on the west side of Highway 509, with the very Tony Fauntleroy neighborhood and Lincoln Park to the west of it, but it's still within the city's boundary, and it's at risk of gentrification. These are kind of the last places in the city where gentrification has yet to really take hold and start. You'll notice that in her ordinance, Herbold gives up on some of those areas where people have long fought gentrification, areas that Mayor Durkin names in her ordinance where she's rubbing her hands saying, let's get down to business and designate these places opportunity zones so investors can make a boatload of money. Places like Soto, like Pioneer Square, Beacon Hill, the Central District, Gessler Terrace, First Hill, all these places that are where gentrification is well underway. Herbold's ordinance basically gives up, says, no, we can't do anything about that now. I found that very, very interesting.
Yeah, and Herbold actually gives a citation or citations in terms of why she identified the neighborhoods
yeah.
that she identified.
And it's based on city statistics and city reports, and that makes sense. But essentially it is, she's just in this ordinance, it really just reveals the long process of Seattle being remade into a mostly white, high-tech neighborhood of large city of mostly wealthy people.
Yeah. And getting back to the Housing Trust Fund, of course, Herbal, before she was on city council, was a legislative aide to Nick Licata for many years on city council. And one of the last major fights that Licata had when he was on city council was trying to raise the rate in which developers had to pay into the Housing mm-hmm. Trust Fund for affordable development. Licata was ultimately unsuccessful in raising it nearly as much as he thought was appropriate to raise it, but that was a major fight, and Herbolt was around for that, and she has not forgotten that as a priority for trying to create more affordable housing and one-to-one replacement.
Yeah, and interestingly, Herbolt cited a study of the University District upzone when she introduced this ordinance, and that upzone was completed in 2017. The study was performed by the City Council Central staff. It found that displacement in the University District in the past 2 years has been at a rate 3.5 times higher than the maximum rate estimated by the city when it originally proposed the upzone. The city had said that they expected between 40 and 275 units of existing affordable housing would be torn down in the decade following the upzone. But just in the last 2 years, at least 96 units of affordable housing have been identified as potentially being lost to displacement for buildings that are in the planning stages. If that can happen in 2 years, Herbold is saying, then the city's estimates are way off.
Yeah,
is necessary.
Yeah,
at this
and
point.
She also cited the city's estimate that over the coming 20 years, 574 units of housing would be demolished in rezone areas citywide, which is preposterous, honestly, because yeah. that number of units are being torn down almost every year. It's certainly not going to be the total over 20 years, but it's to developers' advantage to grossly underestimate that for political purposes, and
that appears to be what the MHA does.
Yes, and that's certainly the. Herbold has identified that as a grossly inaccurate estimate mm-hmm. that needs to be addressed by city council.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, when you were initially talking about the mayor's proposed new opportunity zones, I just always assumed Seattle was a giant opportunity zone for developers.
Zone, yeah.
So my question is with the one-to-one replacement, which seems very reasonable, it still doesn't, at least so far of my reading, I haven't seen anything. So what do people do when they get knocked out of their existing space? I mean, while they wait for the couple of years for the new affordable
They go elsewhere.
Where do they go?
The one-to-one replacement is not meant to replace the people who are actually residents there and provide them a new home immediately. That's not what one-to-one means. It means one-to-one replacement of the unit, not replacement of your home necessarily. So, of course, you will be displaced is how gentrification works, or even how development works. The hope is that there's another development within the same neighborhood that is opening at that time so that you can go to a unit with the same that's of the same cost level, so that there's a replacement unit waiting for you when you are being displaced.
That sounds like it's pretty heavy
and
on
that's,
the hope.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
The hope.
That's
yeah.
the key word is hope.
Yeah, that's the way it's supposed to function, but not the way it's been functioning at all.
Yeah, certainly not how it's been operating in the real world.
No. And it's interesting, too, the whole opportunity zone concept was supposed to say, okay, there are these very, very low income areas, hopefully rural areas, that a state will designate or a state and cities will designate as opportunity zones that then big employers can go and locate there and employ people and lift their sinking economy in a rural area or an impoverished town that's dying. And that's not how Durkin is envisioning opportunity zones at all. She's envisioning them as taking portions of a city that is the fastest growing, one of the fastest, if not the fastest growing city in the nation, and designating those neighborhoods that are the fastest growing in the fastest growing city in the nation, and designating those as opportunity zones so that the investors who are already making boatloads of money can make it at lower tax rates.
That reminds me, and this gets back to the very long memory that some of us sitting at this table have, back in the 90s when the old Frederick and Nelson building downtown was designated as an urban blight building, and that was used to provide city funds to underwrite development of a key stretch of downtown
that was already under
which is now the retail zone and is some of the most valuable real estate in the city. So there's a long precedent for this.
Mark Wirth pointed out in the forum we had this last summer about that,
sponsored by KODX.
In addition to city funding, they also, I believe, got state funding on
for that,
They really milked that one.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
I got a feeling we'll be talking about
we'll
it.
We'll be talking about it more.
All right. For the next 20 years.
Well, okay. So speaking of state funding, more developments this week with the
state legislature. Yeah, there were a couple. It was this was the week that marks the cutoff for bills to make it out of committee to the floor of whichever chamber they were introduced in order for them to move on and eventually be passed into law and signed by the governor. Two healthcare related bills made that cut. The public option healthcare plan has passed out of committee in both the House and Senate, but has been amended with four principal changes, two in each chamber. The House made two changes. It changed the public option silver plan to provide less of a benefit to patients instead of requiring it to pay for at least 68 to 70% of a patient's costs. It can go lower than that. A bad move, I think. The House also changed the bill to require that the public option be run as a managed care plan that could potentially limit the choice of providers, healthcare providers for patients. The Senate, on the other hand, made two changes of its own. It changed the bill to allow two non-standardized plans in each tier of on the healthcare exchange after 2025, instead of banning non-standardized plans altogether, opening the door to competition from lower cost, lower benefit private insurance plans.
Yeah, they don't cover anything.
Yeah, and then the Senate also changed the bill to reimburse critical, what they call critical access hospitals and community hospitals at least 101% of allowable costs instead of at Medicare rates. Medicare rates are higher than Medicaid, but lower than private insurance rates. This is supposed to help rural hospitals to recover more of their operating costs, but it could open the door to undercutting the affordability of the policies for people who need them. So the bill, the public option, is getting watered down through first through the committee process, and we'll see what changes get made on the floor of these two chambers that will affect it. The second bill that was passed out of that's related to healthcare is the Long-Term Care Trust Act, passed on a 63-33 vote on the House floor, and that bill will now pass on to the Senate for consideration. That's Washington residents who make who work at least 4 hours per week would pay a small part of their wages, less about half of a percent of their wages, into a fund that would pay for long-term care costs if they become disabled. To qualify to use the benefit, a person would need to have paid into the fund for at least 3 years within the previous 6 years, or for a total of 10 years, including 5 uninterrupted years in that sequence. You could draw on the benefit if you have trouble completing 3 tasks of daily living, like cooking, eating, bathing, dressing, taking your medication, etc. You could use the money to pay for things like a caregiver, meal delivery, home health service, or a disability-related improvement to your home or living space, like a wheelchair ramp or a wheelchair lift.
So how is that different than the COPES program that the state already administers?
I don't know that covers anything about that program.
Okay. It covers things like home health care and some of those issues.
For disabled folks, people on disability?
Yeah, not necessarily people on disability. The state has its own criteria for that, and they tend to be fairly strict about
I think this would be extended to all Washington residents is the difference, and it's going to be funded by withholding from your pay of a little bit more than half of a percent of your pay of your paycheck. And we know that both long-term care services and long-term care insurance are really expensive. So this is a decent policy meant to be a state policy for folks who can't find long-term care insurance or can't afford long-term care, the benefit would max out at $36,500. But that would still help a lot of people afford some basics that would keep them from becoming bankrupt and homeless.
Yeah.
Or relying on Medicaid.
It would afford some basics, but honestly, for those kind of services, that money will go very quickly.
It would go very quickly, yeah. But it would delay.
It's a start.
Yeah, it's a start. It would delay people going on to Medicaid right away, or it would delay that process a little bit, and that would save taxpayers some money. And there was one more bill I want to just mention that could make it to the Senate floor is Senate Bill 5947. It's a bill to address agriculture's impact on climate change. The bill would create a grant program to assist farmers with adopting carbon reduction practices. It would promote practices like no-till, cover cropping, composting, and other practices that reduce chemical fertilizers, fuel use, and pesticide use. And it would encourage farmers to plant more trees and shrubs to serve as windbreaks, to cool down soil and streams, and to sequester carbon. Trees and shrubs can also serve as habitat for birds and small wildlife, so there's a habitat preservation or restoration component built into it, too. The bill has support from both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate, so it has a very good chance of passing to the Senate floor and eventually passing out of the chamber. That would be really great news.
All right. So I guess we're on to national and the Trump administration's legal circus.
Well, first we should mention that you're listening to KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle. And if you appreciate what you're hearing, KODX is an all-volunteer news and public affairs station, and we really appreciate your donations. There's a Patreon button at the website, which is kodxseattle.org. And, if you appreciate what you're hearing, we could certainly use the help. Because
yes.
We can't do it without you.
We are an all-donation-funded station, so...
And if you're one of the folks who prefers to not donate online but to write a check, you can send a check to us. It should be written out to Earth on the Air, Independent Media, P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And we'll repeat that again at the end of the broadcast.
And big thanks to everybody that contributed this week. Mm-hmm. You rock!
Absolutely.
We could Every bit helps.
We absolutely, literally could not do it without you.
That's right.
Yes.
All right. So on to national. Were there any developments this week?
No, it was another dull week in Washington. But in Kremlin on the Potomac, there were a lot of developments, actually. First, I want to talk about Trump's cabinet, which had a very bad week. Trump's labor secretary is in a great deal of hot water for his actions while U.S. attorney for Southern Florida and his deal with Jeffrey Epstein. That's the billionaire who was convicted of running, certainly participating in and running a child sex ring he wound up getting a plea deal that was ruled illegal this week because there was no notification for the victims, the minor victims of his Epstein's depredations. And this is something that the families of the victims have been doggedly pursuing for over a decade now to try and get that plea deal revisited. It was highly irregular. And
wasn't Acosta key in brokering that plea deal?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. And it was his actions that were ruled illegal by a federal judge.
And now he's our labor secretary.
Yes. And any other administration, he would have lost his job already, but he hasn't. And it seems like, prostitution rings are a big deal in Southern Florida because we also found out of another one, Robert Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, and a close friend of Donald Trump, was named as one of the 25 Johns who will be prosecuted for multiple visits to the Orchids of Asia Day Spa in South Florida as part of a prostitution and sex trafficking ring involving Chinese nationals primarily. Another former cabinet member, Ryan Zinke, is facing grand jury indictments possibly in D.C. One of the many investigations that was pursuing Zinke when he was forced to resign a few months ago has been referred to a grand jury for lying to investigators involving his reversing a previous decision by the Department of the Interior and denying Connecticut casino applications after donations from MGM Resorts International opposing those casino applications.
And the casino applications were for a Native American tribe, right?
Yes, that is correct.
So essentially, he took a bribe from a MGM to deny an application to a competing Native American group that wanted to build a casino.
Yes, and just for context here, because it's very easy to lose sight of this, in 8 years of Barack Obama's administration, there were no serious investigations,
yes,
not only of Obama, but of any of his cabinet members. It's
to find a Trump administration cabinet member who isn't under some kind of cloud of scandal of some kind.
Yeah, Betsy DeVos is facing some new allegations.
Maybe Elaine Chao might escape that, but most of the rest of them are...
Oh, we've still got time.
Yeah, there's still time, I guess.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Trump's former lawyer and personal fixer, Michael Cohen, is facing a big week this coming week, testimony before three congressional committees, one of which next Wednesday will be an open testimony. That's going to be a media frenzy. His date for reporting to his jail sentence was moved from March 6th to May 6th because he's in high demand right now for not only testimony to Congress, but also his cooperation with the Southern District of New York. It came out this week that he's been meeting with investigators for the Southern District about not just his existing investigations, but also things like Trump Organization irregularities regarding allegedly fraudulent insurance claims, illegal donations to the Inauguration Committee for Donald Trump. It hints at a much broader SDNY investigation into the Trump Organization's practices than was previously known. They have crossed that magical red line that Trump made reference to a couple of years ago about not wanting to see federal prosecutors looking at his personal business practices. That's going to get a lot of scrutiny, not just from the SDNY, but also from several different congressional committees that have indicated that they want to subpoena various witnesses regarding Trump Organization practices. Let's see. We also found out, according to Bloomberg News this week, that the New York Attorney General has charges ready for former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort should Trump pardon him. So that's a plan B that Robert Mueller almost certainly was involved in setting
up. Trump can do nothing about state charges.
No, he can. He does not have jurisdiction over state charges. And finally, a reminder to be very skeptical of hyperventilating media speculation as to when Mueller will send a report to William Barr or when he will, quote unquote, end his investigation. Bear in mind that with the arrest of Roger Stone, Mueller's office got a whole bunch of new evidence from Trump's electronic devices, electronic devices, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the immediate circle around Trump, people like his family members, have not been indicted yet or charged with anything. That's likely to change. So there's a lot more to come. And there's an open question as to whether the new attorney general will try to suppress some of those possible charges, or for that matter, suppress the report.
Or maybe put pressure on Mueller to wrap things up already.
Yeah, and we would have no way necessarily of knowing other than forced congressional testimony whether that would be the case or not. But the media speculation they're hearing over that, they don't really know anything, honestly. They don't know a whole lot more than you or I know. So take it all with a big grain of salt.
Okay. All right. Moving on, states jumping in to challenge the emergency proposal.
This week, 16 states, including New York and California, but not Washington State just yet, sued this week to block Trump's emergency declaration to get the funds that Congress wouldn't give him to build the wall on the border with Mexico. The suit was filed in the federal district court in San Francisco, and it contends that the president doesn't have the power to go against Congress on funding decisions. Only Congress has the power of the purse. The plaintiffs are likely to rely on Trump's own words when he announced in his emergency speech, quote, "I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster," end quote. Also, there's the facts that the statistics don't support him. There are fewer people crossing the border now than there were in the 1970s, the 1980s, or even in 2000. And government reports show that most drugs are being smuggled through ports of entry, not places that are out in the boonies. They're not being floated across the Rio Grande and then humped across the desert by people who, if they're carrying anything, are carrying a bottle of water.
There's also the very relevant matter that Trump's entire national security apparatus has testified to Congress as to their assessment of national security threats, and the southern border was simply not mentioned.
Not on the list, yeah. Two other lawsuits have already been filed. One was brought by Public Citizen, which filed suit on behalf of Texas landowners and a Texas environmental group. And the other lawsuit was filed by three other groups, the Center for Biological Diversity, Defenders of Wildlife, and the Animal Legal Defense Fund, to block construction of the wall for environmental reasons. Two other lawsuits are expected to be filed soon. The ACLU has said that it will sue, but we don't know who, on whose behalf they will file the suit
or when.
And Protect Democracy has said it will sue on behalf of El Paso County, which is anticipating that they will suffer economic harm from Trump's continual slander about high crime rates in El Paso and El Paso County, which is simply not true.
Yeah, and also House Democrats have said that they are preparing laws.
Yes. Trump further muddied the waters by saying that he would tap and spend the money in a specific order. First, the $1.375 billion that Congress provided him, then the $600 million from the Treasury and so on, and leave the emergency declaration money to be spent last. So
Doesn't suggest an emergency.
No, so not an emergency, right? Yeah, that's not going to help him in the lawsuit. In addition, the rule that lets the Pentagon shift anti-drug program money into an account for Trump to spend on the wall says explicitly that it may be used, quote, in no case where the item for which funds are requested has been denied by Congress, end quote. That's to specifically prevent things like Iran-Contra, for example, and of course, the Trump border wall. So that's also fodder for a lawsuit or several of them and could stop him in his tracks. The other states joining the lawsuit include Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, and Virginia, but not Washington State yet. Our governor and attorney general have said that they are still investigating the harm that this declaration could cause on Washington State before they jump in and file a suit. They want to have their ducks all in a row, I guess.
Yeah, but they have said that they are pursuing the lawsuit.
That they are looking into it.
Yep.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. So also this week, the Trump administration retaliating against California.
Yeah. Two actions taken by the Trump administration this week really look like direct retaliation against the state of California for perhaps this lawsuit, but for other lawsuits that have been filed, particularly in Trump's immigration rulings.
Yeah. And because they don't rake their forests properly.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, I guess New York, who was the other lead plaintiff in this current lawsuit against the Trump administration, is exempt because, of course, Trump owns a lot of property in New York. So they get a pass. On Tuesday, the Trump administration canceled a $929 million Federal Transportation Department grant for the California High-Speed Rail Authority to build its San Francisco to Los Angeles bullet train line. The grant had already been awarded, but not paid, because the state of California was still putting together the matching funds to qualify for the full amount of the grant. In addition, Trump and the Federal Transportation Department, maybe Elaine Chao is involved in some scandals, I don't know, said that they were looking at their legal options for clawing back $2.5 billion that has already been paid to California for this project. So the Trump administration wants to get California to try to pay all that money back.
Yes. They also have philosophical objections to public transit.
Yeah. Of course, transportation funds are allocated to the states by Congress, which has the power of the purse, again, not the president. So there will inevitably be a lawsuit over the cancellation of the grant. And
I would love to see the some sort of study as to the amount of taxpayer money that has been spent over the past couple of years to defend the Trump administration against the lawsuits.
Against their legal fumblings. Yeah,
yeah, uh-huh. against the lawsuits that for actions that are plainly unconstitutional.
Yeah, yeah, that would be a really good study. If anyone in the nonprofit arena is listening or the think tank arena is listening,
yes.
Please get on it.
Russia, if you're listening.
We would like to know. We would like to know, yeah. 2 days later on Thursday, the Trump administration ended talks with California over its emission rules. California has long had the ability to set its own fuel efficiency standard, emissions standard, separate from the federal government. Obama's clean air standards would have doubled fuel economy standards by 2025. Trump just tossed those in the trash, and now he's ended negotiations with California over their own rules, their own state rules, and says he wants to force California to adhere to federal standards. This means that the dozen other states that follow the California rules would also have to adhere to federal standards if it comes down to a lawsuit and California loses in court, although I don't think that that's likely. The EPA has not yet released their revised rules that Trump has asked them to release. They were supposed to release them in late March, but because of the federal government partial shutdown, those have been delayed now until at least May or possibly June. So we don't yet know what the standards are that Trump wants California to adhere to, yet he's just cut off negotiations and said, done talking to you, bye. So there's your Trump administration retaliation against California's attempts to get the Trump administration to follow the Constitution.
All right. And popping back over the other side of the country, North Carolina having some interesting developments there with elections.
Yeah, the controversial election in Congressional District number 9 in North Carolina in the past midterms, that is the one seat in Congress that has not yet been filled. That's because the Republican who ostensibly won that election by a few hundred votes, Mark Harris, did it in part by employing a consultant that apparently stuffed the ballot with absentee votes that did not exist. The North Carolina Elections Board overturned the results of that election.
The scheme was a little more complex than that.
Yes, it was.
What they did is they talked people into, instead of voting at the polls, to ordering up absentee ballots, and then they sent their own operatives around to collect those absentee ballots. Often blank, and sometimes only partially filled out, other times not sealed. So there's some question of whether they altered some that had already been voted. And then they voted the ones that were blank, maybe altered the ones that were not sealed, and mailed them in. And that's not legal in North Carolina.
For a number of different reasons.
Yeah.
The North Carolina Elections Board had been investigating that for the past couple of months. And this week they overturned the results of that election and ordered a
unanimously.
New election. Unanimously.
Three Democrats and two Republicans.
Yes. And the results of that investigation were referred to the North Carolina Attorney General. The North Carolina Attorney General, in turn, referred the investigation result information from that to a grand jury for possible criminal charges as well. And of course, if for some reason the results of that or a new election and that have some sort of screwy results, the House of Representatives itself has the right not to seat the winner of that election. So they have the ultimate say in who's going to represent their citizens of that district.
What disturbed me about this whole thing is L. McRae Dowless, the guy who ran that operation. Mm-hmm. It looks like Mark Harris, the candidate in the 9th District in North Carolina, had hired him because Dowless had done this before on behalf of other Republican candidates.
Yes.
So it's not a new process. This election fraud in this one election is not an isolated incident in North Carolina, apparently.
Yeah. And one of the more dramatic moments in the testimony before the Elections Board this past week was when Harris's own son testified that he warned Harris that this guy was fraudulent and had this history of doing this. Mm-hmm. So Harris knew. He hired him anyway.
Yeah, and it's interesting that the Republicans who keep saying, election fraud, therefore we must keep these low-income minority people from voting because, potentially they could be illegal immigrants, blah, 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 when it's Republican operatives who are engaging in election fraud in this case.
Yeah,
and a repeated pattern of it in North Carolina.
And they actually use the term voter fraud. putting the burden on the voters where it's the rest of us using election fraud. So,
that's an interesting point.
As with many Republican talking points, it's a matter of projection.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, more Democratic candidates entering the field.
Yeah. Of course, Bernie Sanders entered the field this week.
With record fundraising.
Oh, yeah. In his first 24 hours, record fundraising. If there's, one thing that Democrats have learned from Hillary Clinton's loss, it's that you have to speak to the issues that are important to minority voters, particularly Black voters, or they won't turn out for you. And they didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton in the same numbers that they did for Barack Obama. And a Democrat really can't win without...
I can explain that.
Yeah, and a Democrat really can't win without the support of African Americans, Native Americans, and Latino Democratic voter.
And that's also one reason why the presidential field is far more diverse than any in history.
We're seeing two really big changes this year, more diverse field on the Democratic ticket, and candidates talking a lot more about the issues that matter to people of color. Bernie Sanders declared this week he's a white guy, sure, and, Representative John Delaney was probably the first white guy and the first candidate to say, I want to run for president. And of course, Michael Bloomberg and Joe Biden are still kind of not saying whether they'll run or not yet, so they could jump in too. But there are many, many more women this year than in 2016, including Elizabeth Warren, Tulsi Gabbard, Kirsten Gillibrand, Amy Klobuchar, and Kamala Harris. And Harris is really not the only minority candidate in the race, which is really refreshing to see. There's also Cory Booker, Julian Castro, and Richard Ojeda are also running. So, the mainstream press, of course, has been really nervous about what these folks might say on the campaign trail to rouse support for their candidacy among people of color. And, the mainstream press always gets really nervous when people of color speak out and speak up about issues that are important to them.
Only if they're forced to actually cover it.
Yeah, and by mainstream press, I'm also including Fox News, because Fox News has a very high viewership. Fox News this week went really crazy over the R word, and by that I mean reparations. But even the New York Times and the Washington Post nearly fainted when Kamala Harris said that, yes, of course, our society owes reparations to Black Americans for the legacy of slavery. What she said was this. She said, quote, "We have to be honest that people in this country do not start from the same place or have access to the same opportunities. I'm serious about taking an approach that would change policies and structures and make real investments in Black communities," end quote. And that's not controversial. You would think that's not controversial.
And that gets to a lot of different statistics, including locally in Seattle and King County, that
we just saw our mayor say something like,
yes, we did.
Essentially, and more diversity.
Yeah,
right?
and the statistics are that accumulated wealth among households in the United States, both locally and nationally, there's an enormous disparity between the wealth, and a lot of this has to do with home ownership, but it's also other assets and savings, et cetera. The wealth disparity between white Americans and minorities, especially African Americans, is huge. And it continues to be huge generation after generation. And this is why 150 years on from slavery and a half century after the ostensible end of Jim Crow, we're still talking about not only enormous but growing wealth inequalities in the United States.
Yeah, and wealth is important because it's separate from income. Income is what you make in a year. Wealth is what you own from day to day. Do you own your house? How much equity do you have in your house? Do you own your car? Are you paying a huge auto loan, or is it mostly paid for? Do you own any savings, or do you only have credit card debt, student loan debt, auto loan, huge mortgage, et cetera? And what we're finding is that people who belong to minority groups in the United States often have not just very little wealth, they have a negative wealth balance because they owe so much money. In terms of auto loans, not even student loans necessarily, but maybe court debts for things like traffic tickets and that kind of stuff. And that a lot of municipalities make a lot of money off of their lowest income residents by slamming them with court debts, late payment fees, additional fines for not paying on time, et cetera, et cetera. And that is the, I would argue, the opposite of reparations. It is absolute discrimination.
Yeah, it's also a transfer of wealth from people who have the least of it to the people who have the most of it. And we've been seeing that process on steroids over the last 40 years in this country. And it's a major reason why, when you talk about, whether you talk about Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax proposal or mm-hmm. Alexandria or Ocasio-Cortez talking about changing the maximum tax rate to 70% for people with very high incomes. Those proposals have caused fainting spells, the need for smelling salts among mainstream media outlets, but they poll very, very well, both among, oddly enough, there's a lot of support even among Republicans, and it's very popular among Democrats. So, it's very smart politics for them to be getting out ahead of this. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be hearing a lot more of it as the primary process goes on.
And reparations is not the only subject which has caused the mainstream media to throw fits in the current race for the Democratic nomination. Things like the Green New Deal, for example, which wasn't originated by any of the candidates who are running for president on the Democratic ticket. It was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez who introduced it in the House. But people like Nancy Pelosi, who's the leader of the Democrats in the House, call it the Green New Dream. And if she's poo-pooing it, she's not reading it, because economists and folks who know how the energy system works in the United States say that it is completely possible to at least fulfill half of the Green New Dream within a decade.
Deal.
The easiest half, which is converting our electricity generation to clean sources. We already have the technology, can be done easily within a decade. The two hard pieces of the Green New Deal are dealing with the transportation emissions and dealing with retrofitting buildings to make them cleaner and more energy efficient. Those are the things that will require investments of money. And that's the sort of thing where a carbon tax really makes sense, or a wealth tax, or capital, or increasing the tax on capital gains, in some way coming up with a new source of revenue. But these things are not, things you should just dream about. These are things that we have to take action on right now, and we have to get started right now if we want to save the planet. And I think if you talk to Democratic voters, particularly anyone under the age of 40, you're going to find that there's huge support for the Green New Deal, and that the mainstream media and that mainstream Democratic politicians and Republican politicians better start taking it seriously and better start getting an action plan in place.
And for a lot of those voters under 40, and particularly people who supported Bernie Sanders in 2016, it's very reminiscent of their frustrations with establishment Democrats who simply weren't listening to the concerns of mm-hmm. everyday Americans, and poo-pooing climate change proposals like the Green New Deal just shows how out of touch they are with their own base.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we've literally got kids now marching in the streets and doing protests across the world successfully to point out that, the clock is, literally ticking.
Yeah. And the Green New Deal says 10 years. Some pieces of it may have to go to 20 years, but to reach any of those goals, we have to start now. And to reach those goals in time to keep the planet something, and our climate something that's recognizable to us and that is still friendly to human race's survival, we have to start now. We can't just dream about it and start it in 25 years or something.
Yeah, and even the parts of the Green New Deal or proposals like it that require substantial investment, that is an investment that pays off if it ameliorates the effects of climate change, because climate change is already having an enormous cost
expensive.
On the economy.
Yes,
it already is, and mm-hmm. just in terms of we talked last week about the economic cost.
Yeah, do you spend the money up front, or do you spend the money later trying to clean up the aftermath?
We talked to you last week about the economic cost just of unnatural climate events.
Events.
Ah, okay. Well, we got some coming up. Let's see. Today, there's a rally against far-right violence.
Well,
same thing.
Works.
Basically, yeah. 4:30 this afternoon at the north end of the quad of the University of Washington main campus, the upper campus. That is sponsored by Radical Women and a whole host of other socialist groups. Tomorrow, the 24th of February, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., an NAACP Know Your Rights presentation and free legal clinic that will be held at the Washington State Labor Council, 321 16th Avenue South in Seattle. On Monday, the 25th, from 5 to 9 o'clock, there will be a rally to save the Ave at Big Time Brewery and Ale House at 4133 University Way Northeast here in a beautiful university district. Saturday, March 2nd, coming up next weekend, the Transit Writers Union will be having its annual event from 1 to 4:30 in the afternoon. Whose City Is It? Keynotes include former interim city council member Kirsten Harris-Talley and a number of other great speakers that will be at the Seattle Labor Temple in Belltown. And also coming up next weekend on Sunday, the 3rd of March, will be the rescheduled memorial for journalist Rick Anderson. That will be at Victory Lounge, 4433 East Lake Avenue East between Harrison and Republican in the South Lake Union neighborhood.
All right.